welcome to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody today. Wendy Wilson, and the Reverend Butch. Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs will be joining us in a few minutes with her always pithy, healthy insights. Then in the second and third segments, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Hump Day, Wednesday, June 22nd, 2022. Hello, world. And, well, Wendy, it's Happy National Chocolate Eclair Day. And more importantly, it's National Kissing Day. So pucker up and give your significant other, pet, or friend a big smooch. Let's get to today's market report, shall we? Gold. Interesting day. It was up early and stayed up, although just $5.40. It's $1,839 in the New York after spot market. Silver, on the other hand, down about a little over 1%. At $21.51 an ounce. Platinum down a little over 1% at $938. And palladium down about 15 bucks at $1,945. In other commodities, we have domestic WTI oil down almost 4%. All the way to $105.40 a barrel. International Brent crude down 3.25% at $111. Back here in the States, U.S. dollar index down about 0.25% at 104.21. Consistent with that, 10-year Treasury yield down to 3.149. 5-year shows an inversion at 3.225. And the 30-year, the longer term's at 3.23%. In the paper markets, equities up, down, all around today. Had all three of the major indexes were up until just a little bit ago. Dow Jones closing down about 47 points to 30,483. Broader S&P 500 down about 5 points at 3760. And the NASDAQ down 16 points at 11,053. And that, we can say, is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And now, pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Wendy, hello.
Hey, Dave. Good to
talk
with
you. What are we talking about today? Yeah, you too.
Thank you. I thought we'd look at some more information on the monkeypox situation. And, you know, it's all in the news, as you've and people are talking about it, and health departments are posting things on their websites by in each state. And also recently, the CDC tried to mandate air travelers to wear face masks again to prevent the spread of monkeypox. But no pun intended, but that didn't fly. So people push back with, you know, knowledgeable objections that the disease was usually spread by body fluid contact. The CDC did back down on that. However, news outlets with interviewing experts are saying to the public that the smallpox is transmissible through air droplets. Wear your masks, they're saying. And we went over that before a few weeks ago, that really for a person to get infected through breathing air droplets, you'd have to be in contact with the affected person for a significant amount of time. So you'd probably have to be that person's caregiver, for instance. Wearing masks probably won't be mandated, at least I hope not. But really what we have here is a situation where we have world leaders, practicing interesting behaviors with bioterroristic threats, and the government can really import a pandemic if they want to, or plant one in another country these days. That's really simple to do. So outbreak fever really has engulfed the world, and anxiety among the population is running pretty high. Now, your news is talking about preparedness and what the local, state, and your federal authorities are doing. What the heck are they doing? And really, world leaders want a global pandemic really to bring about more control, really, over various sectors. And you're going to hear terms describing responses as rapid or coordinated, which means, you know, movement towards a lockdown once again, and more severe restrictions as health authorities describe smallpox as more infectious of an influenza, and also worse than Ebola. So, and since the smallpox vaccine has really not been used since 1977, you're also going to hear that Americans have no immunity since they quit using it. Countries that have already experienced some severe loss of freedom under your test pandemic called COVID, well, that would be the UK, Canada, and Australia. So here's a quote from Irina McIntyre. She's a professor at Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Australia University in New South Wales. And she said, this can then spread around the world in weeks. We modeled the worst case scenario. In this case, the impact on the world would be worse than a nuclear attack, and it would take over 4 years to control the epidemic. So that's, you know, spreading a bit of fear into people when you see stuff like that. So within days of announcing your monkeypox infectious disease epidemiology experts in your bioterrorism areas, we're already designing the outbreak scene for the world leaders. And remember, Dave, coordinated efforts is critical, and it's expected that your world leaders and the citizens should accept these preventative steps and obey. So Dr. McIntyre says also, it is critical that all efforts and resources be focused on the source of the epidemic, on the area of the world which struggles to achieve containment. So what Professor McIntyre is revealing is the United States has enough smallpox vaccine on hand for all of the U.S. population. So this in itself should tell us that this has been kind of in the planning phase, and vaccines have a very short shelf life. So in 2003, when pandemics were really not the plot in the plot just yet, we were, you know, coming off that financial meltdown, the housing bubble, and the reports from the UCLA Department of Epidemiology School of Public Health stated that due to the lack of demand, the U.S. destroyed over 81,000 doses. That's 810 vials of smallpox vaccine they had on hand. So 1,000 vials, Dave, contains 100 doses, and the smallpox vaccine has a 90-day expiration date once it's being opened and to be used. Now, here's the smallpox cost. Non-replicating strains, $4.85. Replicating strains, $28.50. And administrative costs and training to get that stuff rolled out, $257.44. That's your infrastructure to deliver vaccines.
Per dose.
So the U.S. Government has invested $82,560,000 to cover the U.S. population with smallpox vaccine. And when it is prepared for use, it has a 90-day shelf life. So what the government hopes to do is have everyone vaccinated with smallpox. I think they may be shooting for end of summer or end of this year. Now, here's something really scary and interesting, Dave. In 2003, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health received about $1 million to run its smallpox campaign, although it did not include the cost of the vaccine, which was given directly to them by the federal government. Mm-hmm. So the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease testified before the Senate panel in 2003 that the nation had 15 million doses of smallpox vaccine in reserve, and that testing showed the available vaccine would remain potent enough even if they diluted it to create as many as 75 million doses. So that's an interesting statement, because the vaccine could be diluted 500%, and they're saying it's still potent enough of a vaccine to protect you from smallpox. So my mind goes to, okay, so the original dose must be very toxic. So it
that
sounds,
all of us got way back.
Right. So at the time, the FDA has had the power also to extend expiration dates, usually by 3 months. So if there's an expiration date extension, they would say the smallpox, you know, vaccine would remain in use. Now, here is a quote from UCLA Department of Epidemiology, School of Public Health. They say smallpox was officially eradicated in 1977, with the last naturally occurring case reported in Somalia. But the attacks of September 11th, they said, as well as the arrival of anthrax-related letters, remember that?
Hmm? Yeah.
That fueled fears of a rogue agent might attempt to use smallpox as a tool of terrorism. Oh,
scary
so
stuff.
It is. So they also are saying the smallpox inoculation campaign was hampered in 2003 from its inception. First, by concerns among healthcare workers who would pay their medical bills should they fall ill from the vaccine and whether they could continue to get paid while recovering. So the vaccine is generally safe, they say, but compared to immunizations that are widely given today, it does have a higher risk, with prevalence showing that 1 to 2 recipients per million could die from when they receive it. Now, other statistics I found were actually 29% of this vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, post-vaccination encephalitis, and people died from swelling of the brain. So 29% of those who got it died from brain inflammation, and then 5% died from necrosis vaccine. So what happened is that the vaccine caused necrosis of the cells, and people died from toxicity.
Wow.
So I know. It's not a very nice vaccine. They haven't been using it much since 77, except for maybe on the military or people traveling to areas where they know smallpox has been a problem. But it has a really high side effect rate. Here is Dr. McIntyre. She said, advances in genetic engineering and synthetic biology have increased the risk of such bioterroristic attacks. So, you know, just priming the pump, getting us ready. It's, you know, pandemics and plagues are in your future. Just get used to it. 700 million doses. World Health Organization has 35 million doses. So they seem to have everything in stock, you know, which is kind of surprising since this monkeypox just popped up so quickly.
Out of nowhere.
It takes 12 to 18 months to make this serum. You know what I mean? Here's some of the side effects from the smallpox vaccine: itching, swollen lymph nodes, sore arm at the injection site, fever, headache, body aches, rash, and fatigue. The life-threatening reactions are acute eczema rashes, necrosis, ulcerations, and encephalitis, brain swelling, and death. Now, the difference from the smallpox to the monkeypox is kind of generally the same, with the exception where they say the monkeypox doesn't seem to be as severe, and you may get more swelling of the lymph nodes with the monkeypox one. So,
jeez.
I know. So here we are. And so we're looking for safer alternatives, I think, in this day and age we're in. And one of the things that I found was, you know, during our nation's inception, where – you know, we were trying to corral the Native American Indians into reserves, and the U.S. military gave them blankets. Do you remember that?
I'm coming back.
Yes. And so it was said that they had laced the blankets they gave to the Indians with smallpox, and the Indians came down with smallpox. And this was a new disease to the Native American Indians. This was a European disease, typically. So, but the Native American Indians are quite fond of using medicinal plants, and they learn quite quickly which plant has an inhibitor to smallpox virus, and it's called the pitcher's plant. Now, the pitcher's plant isn't really grown these days, especially in the United States, as a medicinal plant and in bulk. It's grown as a ornamental plant. It's in the same genus family as the Venus flytrap plant. Okay.
How about that?
Right?
I've never heard of.
Well, and they call it the pitcher's plant because of how it grows. It looks like a spout, like a pitcher's spout. And it's very colorful, green and orange and yellow, and it's very vibrant. It looks very ornamental. So I've had a hard time. It's taken me like 8 months to find something, something to as a provision, you know, a line of support where you can get these plants, and it's hard to come by because it's ornamental only. I did find a vendor, though. I did find a vendor, though, that is supplying seeds, roots, and plants. So we were able to secure some of those, and we are coming out with a pitcher's plant product in about a couple of weeks.
Wow.
So, yeah, some of the herbs.
The post-coronavirus pandemic supply snafus.
I tell you.
Hit the pitcher plant.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, it's not grown like your other medicinals, like echinacea, and these really very popular medicinal plants that growers, you know, produce and grow in bulk, where you can get pounds and pounds of it. So the pitcher's plant's an ornamental, and they just don't grow in that kind of volume. But we did get some, so we're going to be adding that to the product line. So it has an inhibitor in it to the smallpox, just like gentian root has an inhibitor to Ebola, your hemorrhagic fevers. And by the way, there is a hemorrhagic version of smallpox. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, so what happens is you get those lesions that smallpox would give you, but they tend to bleed and hemorrhage. So they call it the hemorrhagic version of smallpox. So get your gentian root, get your pitcher's plant ready, just in case, because you'll have inhibitors to those viruses in the system. And, you know, I don't think God left us defenseless in this age. He already knew was coming.
It sounds like we're going to be hearing more about this in the coming months.
Well, I mean, I think people are kind of just worn out with COVID, and people aren't
for
really,
sure.
They're not even you know, wearing masks where I live anymore. They're not. Are they wearing masks where you are?
I've only seen them in hospitals and. Very, very few otherwise in other places where a lot of people congregate, like particularly outdoors. So very, very few. I'd say less than 5%.
Yeah. See, people are kind of just over it now.
Yeah.
So they're kind of rolling out another one, but we'll see what happens with it. But if anybody'd like a free catalog, we offer those. You can just call us toll free at 866-229-3663. 866-229-3663, or visit us online at thepowerherbs.com. And don't forget to sign up for the newsletters, American Survival.
You got it. Wendy Wilson, Apothecary Herbs, thank you so much. Very interesting segment today. Folks, go to that website. You'll find a lot of information there. We hear the music. That means we're going to break for a few important messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival. You're listening to Wednesday's edition, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody. We're on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, or toll free again at 1-800-375-4188. Washington, D.C., eyebrows are raised these days. Senators from both parties are skeptical that the Federal Reserve's policies can quell food and gas inflation. I mean, go figure. That was a recurring theme yesterday as Fed Chair Jerome Powell began 2 days of congressional testimony on monetary policy. The hearings, which are continuing today, are hinting at the type of pressure that Powell faces from lawmakers as their constituents grapple with nosebleed prices and growing recession risks. Here are two exchanges that illustrate the angst about the Fed's role in the inflation fight. First is from Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota, who said the portion of inflation which Americans are feeling today may not just be the core inflation that some of your tools address, speaking to Powell. And the second from Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who said, told Powell, inflation is like an illness and medicine needs to be tailored to the specific problem. Otherwise, you could make things a lot worse. Right now, the Fed has no control over the main drivers of rising prices. Well, Democrats quiz Powell about whether the Fed's moves to rein in inflation could tip the economy into a recession. Powell acknowledged that it was a possibility, but not something the Fed was trying to provoke. To quote that great philosopher Homer Simpson, duh. Now, some Republicans piled on Powell, calling out the Fed for being too slow to react to these inflationary pressures. You'll recall for close to a year, Powell and many of his colleagues on the Fed were calling it transitory or temporary. Not so. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis said, though I'm pleased you have begun taking drastic action necessary to right the U.S. economy, these actions are long overdue and monetary policy remains too loose. I'll talk, our Melody and I will talk about today's testimony before the House Financial Services Committee on tomorrow's program. Should be a doozy. Now, related story, job security jitters appear to be on the rise. Certainly, why not? Recession chatter all over the news. Now, the job market's still strong with headline employment at 3.6%, although it's actually closer or over 7% if you include discouraged job seekers and those working part-time who want a full-time job. But the Fed wants to drive that up a bit to fight inflation, and workers are getting the message. Across all income brackets, the share of workers who fear a loss of employment income over the next month rose in June from the prior month, according to the most recent poll from Morning Consult and Axios. In the lower income group, that's a reversal from May, when job loss expectations were actually trending downward. And among those in the higher income group, the share expecting job loss jumped by more than 5 percentage points to its highest level in the last year, close to 16%. It's worth noting that, especially in the higher income group, the fears don't yet line up with reality. Number of high-income respondents who said they actually lost employment income in the last 4 weeks was about 7%. Now, that's about the same as May. Now, Jesse Wheeler, who's an economic analyst at Morning Consult, observes, I think the feeling is just that something's not right about the economy, and it's starting to spook workers. Well, Jesse, just wait. You ain't seen nothing yet. Now, here's the guy who's been in the news a lot the past year, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, says that unemployment would need to rise significantly for an extended period of time if it has any chance of curbing the inflation that's wreaking havoc on the U.S. and global markets. Summers said on Monday, the other day, we need 5 years of unemployment above 5% to contain inflation. That, again, is headline employment. In other words, we need 2 years of 7.5% employment or 5 years of 6% unemployment or 1 year of 10% unemployment. Now, if you look at the U6 rate, the more accurate, I believe, rate, we're close to double the numbers I just mentioned. That's pretty significant. Inflation historically has an inverse relationship with unemployment. So when inflation is high, unemployment is typically low, and vice versa. In the opinion of Summers, higher unemployment would translate to people having less discretionary income to purchase goods, thus lowering demand and reducing prices. Summers said the gap between 7.5% unemployment for 2 years and 4.1% unemployment for one is immense. He added, is our central bank prepared to do what is necessary to stabilize inflation if something like what I've estimated is necessary? I don't know. We'll see, won't we? Of course, one danger we've been talking about is that unemployment and inflation will fall out of their usual inverse relationship and leave the country in a period of high unemployment and high inflation. That phenomenon of the 70s stagflation. Last time U.S. saw a period of stagflation, in fact, was 1973 after the collapse of the Bretton Woods currency system, which left the dollar in free float. In the face of surging high inflation, Fed Chief Paul Volcker famously brought the Fed funds rate, which currently sits between 1.5 and 1.75%, to over 20%. Of course, that brought on back recessions in 81 and 82 and record high unemployment, but also bringing inflation back down to manageable levels. Summer says the same drastic action maybe need to be taken again. To that end, Jerome Powell says the Fed would do whatever it takes to get prices under control to support a strong labor market. Well, again, we shall see, won't we? Now, we've heard a lot, and we've talked a lot in this program over the past year and a half with the change in issues with the sales of new and used cars and supply chain snafus and the lack of microchips that are necessary and some of the raw material costs for electric vehicles, which most of the large auto companies have committed to transitioning to, have more than doubled during the pandemic. It's according to Alex Partners, and this has been forcing automakers from GM and Tesla to the startups like Lucid and Rivian to significantly raise prices on their new vehicles. The average raw material cost for an EV totaled about $8,300 per vehicle. Now, that's up about 144% from March of 2020 as the pandemic began. It's led by materials like cobalt, nickel, and lithium. They're all essential materials for the batteries used to power electric cars and trucks. Now, EV-specific costs, Alex says, have increased to $4,500 from roughly $2,000
in the past 2 years, more than doubling. The costs aren't limited to electric vehicles. Raw material costs for traditional vehicles, those with internal combustion engines, have also more than doubled during that time period. They're up 106% to over $3,600 per vehicle, generally being led by increases in steel and aluminum. The cost spikes come as automakers aggressively launch new EVs over the next several years. Alex, in fact, predicts the number of EV models available in the global market to increase from 80 last year to more than 200 by 2024. It's not the number of cars, the number of different models. As a result, Alex expects the higher cost to force a relative slowdown in new EV launches as automakers move away from pushing electric vehicles to market and to refocus on profitability. Ford CFO John Lawler said last week that rising commodity costs have literally wiped out the profit that that company expected to make on its electric Mustang Mach EV. While the vehicle was profitable when it was first launched in late 2020, he said that's no longer the case. In the meantime, automakers are raising prices for buyers. GM on Friday announced it would hike the price of its newer electric Hummer by over $6,000. The automaker blamed higher prices for parts, technology, and logistics. Tesla, Rivian, Lucid, and others previously announced big increases in the starting costs of their EVs. Now back in Washington, the IRS says it's making progress on its backlog of unprocessed tax returns, but millions still remain. Two of my late mother's three most recent tax returns are among them. But I'm not complaining. As of June 10th, the IRS had completed around 4.5 million of the more than 4.7 million individual paper returns from 2021, and the agency says it expects to finish error-free individual filings from 2021 this week. The IRS has processed most of the 2022 filings as well, more than 143 million returns, and issued nearly 98 million refunds worth $298 billion. However, the IRS still faces more than twice as many unprocessed tax returns compared with a typical year. There were 11 million pending individual returns as of June 10th, including filings received before 2022 and new 2021 returns. IRS Commissioner Chuck Reddick said completing the individual returns filed last year with no errors is a major milestone, but there is still work left to do. He added that the IRS remains focused on doing everything possible to expedite processing of these tax returns, and we continue to add more people to this effort as our hiring efforts continue this summer. But the IRS, the federal government in general, is not immune, as many private sector employers aren't in this post-pandemic era, as they look to fill many, many vacancies. But Reddick says, barring any unforeseen circumstances, if the world stays as it is today, good luck with that. We'll be what we call healthy by the end of calendar year 2022 and enter the 2023 filing season with normal inventories. Now, Reddick's promise to House lawmakers came about a week after the agency unveiled plans to hire 10,000 new workers to tackle the backlog, thanks to some additional funding from Congress, with 5,000 of those new employees in the coming few months. But the Chief Taxpayer Experience Officer at the IRS, told the House Oversight Committee last month that the agency hadn't yet hired half of those 5,000 workers. Now, beyond highlighting the sky-high cost of college, the pandemic has certainly shed light on the overwhelming burden of student loan debt. Average college tuition and fees edged higher again in the 2021-2022 academic year, reaching just shy of $11,000 for in-state students at four-year public schools. We'll call it $10,700, according to the College Board. Tuition and fees at four-year private institutions hit $38,070. Now, next year, some colleges said they'll be hiking tuition even more because of inflation and other pressures. Most students borrow to cover at least some of the cost of college. As a result, more than 40 million Americans now owe a collective $1.7+ trillion in student debt. It's a balance that's tripled since the Great Recession. Still, many believe that getting a degree is still worth it. Studies show that college graduates will earn about $1 million over the course of their careers. However, there are others who start college and never finish. I think that's $1 million more over the course of their careers than non-college graduates. Although college completion rates are on the rise, only about 63% of students enrolled in four-year institutions graduate within 6 years. For the ones who don't, managing education loans without the benefit of having a higher earning potential with a degree is especially difficult, they say. Default rate among borrowers who leave with student debt but no degree is also three times higher than the rate for borrowers who have a diploma. Among students who put their education on hold, most said it was due to the loss of motivation or a life change. It's according to a recent Sally May report. Others cite financial concerns followed by mental health challenges. Those who finish college are more likely to grow up in households with higher income levels and have at least one parent who earned a college degree. Completers of college also come more prepared when it comes to paying for college. They say 42% said they had a plan for how to pay for every year of college before they even enrolled. Only 26% of non-completers said. And that's all the time we have in this segment. I hope you'll stick around. We're going to have a couple of few messages. And we'll be back. I'm Dave Allen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. It's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. And it's also tea time in many places around the world, not the least of which is Buckingham Palace. Turns out tea, all types of it, is good for you, with benefits that touch everything from your brain to your gut to your immune system. In your brain, L-theanine, which is found in green tea and oolong tea, has been linked to a lower risk of developing cognitive diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And chamomile tea is an effective natural enemy of anxiety. How many of us suffer from that in some respect? In your muscles, chamomile tea also relaxes sore muscles and helps you to sleep. In your immune system, white tea is chock full of antioxidants that have been associated with lower cancer risk. And black tea has all-around immune benefits as well. Your teeth, white tea, it actually has fluoride for your dental health. Of course, black tea can stain your teeth. Your gut, you know, hibiscus tea can curb food cravings. Peppermint tea fights irritable bowel syndrome and constipation. And rooibos tea can boost your good cholesterol and lower your bad cholesterol, at least according to the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. And the perks don't come from drinking alone. You can press steamed and cooled black tea on your cuts and bruises to reduce swelling and relieve pain. But just like with coffee, watch how you drink tea. Adding cream and sugar and syrups to make tea lattes can wipe away the natural benefits and add tons of calories. And don't fall for the slew of detox or weight loss teas that are peddled on Instagram, Facebook, and elsewhere. So look, whether you start your day with coffee or tea or enjoy your tea with thee during financial survival, drink up and reap the benefits. I mean, Queen Elizabeth sure does. By the way, word has it that the Queen drinks Earl Grey tea with a splash of milk and some biscuits in the morning, right before breakfast. Traditionally, working class citizens in England would have tea at around 4 p.m. local time. However, middle and upper class citizens would have tea around 5 to 6, often replacing traditional dinners. Observance of the tea time custom originated among the wealthy social classes in Britain in the 1840s. And now you know. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, back to a more serious note, Kelsey Williams of Kelsey Williams' Gold Blog asks in his most recent blog, if inflation is so bad, why isn't it higher? Recent headlines of many people despairing over inflation, he writes. A couple of recent examples are inflation is the worst it's been in 40 years. Consumer prices are rising rapidly and high inflation is here to stay. So how bad is it? Well, the CPI rate of increase for all of 2021 was 7%, coming on the heels of 2020's 1.4, and after 40 years of historically low inflation, Williams says that 2021 may be viewed by some as nightmare inflation. Just wait till the end of this year. Still, he adds, it doesn't justify the headline proclamations that stir up fear and anxiety among the general population these days. Williams believes there are several things to consider before getting too worked up about what one reads regarding high inflation. First, most of us tend to remember largely what happened most recently and forget or ignore that which may require a bit of effort to uncover from our past. When viewing the 2021 CPI rate of 7% in the context of longer term historical rates, the number doesn't seem quite so extreme, does it? It's true that the spike higher in 2021 was a five-fold increase over 2020, but that's not the whole story. Williams says part of the reason for the jump in prices last year, as we have been talking about, has to do with supply chain disruptions associated with reopening of economies around the globe after being shut down for over a year. And such disruptions can and do cause an imbalance in supply and demand, with the resulting effect on prices having little, if anything, to do with inflation. Some additional perspective helps, too. After peaking at approximately 13% in 1979 and 80, the CPI rate fell to a low of 1.1% in 1986. The next 3 years saw increases of 4.43, 4.42, and 4.65. Then in 1990, the rate jumped 6.1. Of course, the cries of high inflation is back were prevalent then, too. Nevertheless, the CPI rate dropped in half the very next year to less than 3.1% and ushered in 30 years of historically low CPI rates that many of our kids have grown up with and that we've grown old with. What does all this tell us? Well, it tells us a lot of things, but Williams notes that in all cases where extreme increases in CPI are apparent, they've been followed by years and in some cases decades of lower rates of increase. After the CPI rate peaked in 1918 at 20.4%, it trended downward for the past 100 years. Williams warns that the inflation created by the Fed is losing its intended effect. The biggest risk is not significantly higher inflation. Rather, the greater risk is credit default and financial market implosion. Let us know what you think about Williams' thoughts. Send them to me at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. We'll read them on a future program. Now, Americans, deeply unhappy and worried about the price of gasoline for good reason. Every fill up offers consumers sticker shock, and fuel prices are driving up overall inflation, both directly and indirectly, as $5 per gallon of, well, regular gas and over $6 in diesel increases the cost of transporting almost everything. But the wave of frustration is creating some incoherent economic policy thinking in Washington and across many state capitals. The central problem is too much demand for fuel and too little supply. But many of the policy ideas being floated to address high gas prices don't wrestle with that basic disconnect and could, in the long run, be counterproductive. The Biden administration, for example, this morning called for a three-month suspension of the 18-cent per gallon federal gas tax and is encouraging states to consider suspending their own. It's now summer and Americans are hitting the road. Refinery capacity is down over 5% since 2019, and this mismatch is the problem. Refineries are at nearly full capacity, meaning it will be hard to produce much more gasoline in the short run. High prices are essentially the way finite supplies are rationed to drive down demand. The alternative is artificially low prices combined with shortages. So, to get the underlying problem, a policy would need to either reduce demand or increase supply. And many approaches that are being talked about just don't do that. The president's proposed gas tax holiday would have limited benefits, analysts from across the ideological spectrum believe. Tobin Marcus, a strategist at Evercore ISI, said the substantive case for the policy is weaker than ever. He added subsidizing demand in a supply crunch would be counterproductive. The size of the tax cut relative to pump prices is marginal. An elevated refinery utilization means more of the benefit would be captured by the producers rather than the consumers. Well, there are similar problems with other policy ideas as well. California Gov Gavin Newsom is advocating a $400 per vehicle gas tax rebate to help take the sting out of higher prices. Seemingly nice with good intentions on the one hand, but others say that would likely produce higher demand on the other. And on the supply side, some in Congress have advocated a windfall profits tax for energy companies. But if enacted, that could make companies more reluctant to invest in longer-term energy exploration. But I agree that companies that are price gouging should somehow be punished. Windfall profits tax was implemented in 1980, and according to the Congressional Budget Office, reduced domestic oil production by between 1.2% and 8% between 1980 and 88. What would work better? Employ America has produced a creative, if legally questionable, proposal for the Treasury to use the Exchange Stabilization Fund to incentivize energy producers to ramp up output. On the demand side, offering subsidies for mass transit or other more fuel-efficient means of riding could help reduce demand. In any event, weighing policies aimed at reducing gas prices, well, our policymakers need to revisit Econ 101 and think about the impact of their decision, whether it's going to help or hurt. Now, last today, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the federal agency that was created under the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, in response to Wall Street's abuses to average Americans in the lead-up to the Great Recession. One of its key benefits is that it has a complaint database where consumers can post their complaints to the agency and the general public. And reporters can read those complaints on a public website. Now, the general benefits by seeing what types of complaints are being made against a financial institution they might be considering doing business with, that's good. And reporters can look for dangerous emerging patterns. Pam and Russ Martins writing today's Wall Street On Parade newsletter about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies having generated over 2,000 posts on the CFPB website. Even more concerning, Coinbase has received over 3,700 complaints. Now, to wrap your head around how astounding that number of complaints is for such a young company like Coinbase, too big to fail Goldman Sachs, it's been around forever, has generated only 1,200 matches. And that's over the span of more than a decade that the CFPB Complaint Center has been alive, and the great vampire squid has been wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money, to quote the great Matt Taibbi. Coinbase's website carries the slogan, "The future of money is here." Well, the Martins say that based on the gut-wrenching details in the complaints filed with the CFPB, if Coinbase and cryptos in general are indeed the future of money in our country, we are doomed, and every citizen will soon be stuffing their cash under the mattress or burying it in the backyard. The business of Coinbase is trading and storing crypto. Cryptocurrency is a product which has been called a Ponzi scheme by economists Noriel Roubini and former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. It's been called rat poison squared by Warren Buffett and a sham by a growing number of scientists and software engineers. Most importantly here, consider who got rich on this not-ready-for-prime-time company. On its first day of trading, as a direct listing, by the way, in April of 2021, the stock closed at a share price of $328 after spiking to more than $400 during that day, giving it a market cap of $86 billion. In a traditional IPO, early investors and company execs aren't allowed to sell their shares for up to several months under a lockup period. There's no such restriction in a direct listing like Coinbase's was. According to an SEC filing, Coinbase's chair and CEO Brian Armstrong sold 750,000 shares on opening day in April 2021 at an average share price of $389, raising approximately $292 million for himself. Since then, Coinbase has been on a steady descent, closing yesterday at $57, a decline of 82% from that first day of trading. May 27th, just a few, called a month ago, Wall Street Journal reporters revealed that Coinbase co-founders Armstrong and Fred Ersam, as well as president and COO Emily Choi and chief product officer, together netted about $1.2 billion in proceeds from stock sales starting on the day the company began trading through February of last year. Just last week, Coinbase employees learned that 18% of them were going to be sacked. But with your pants down, ladies and gentlemen, unless you have money to blow, stay away from cryptos. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Todd, and to you for tuning in to Financial Survival. I'll be back tomorrow with Melody. Please be safe out there. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. I have a plan. If I got you.